Take Pop Culture Happy Hour and more with you on the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Surprising interviews, your favorite podcasts, and now an easy way to listen to your favorite station live. NPR One is ready to make commuting, cleaning the house, or alone time better. Find NPR One in your app store now.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about what we are watching, reading, and listening to. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. This week, an annual tradition returns as we bring you our Oscars preview. We'll talk about frontrunners, dark horses, and movies that will make you cry. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. But before we get started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table.
I'm Stephen Thompson with NPR Music.
I'm Glenn Weldon. I write for the NPR website.
And in our fourth chair this week, as is tradition during Oscar season, is Bob Mondello, who is a film critic for All Things Considered. Hi, Bob.
Good to be here.
Now, as you probably know, there are nine Best Picture nominees. They have the system now where there can be anywhere between 5 and 10. They seem to settle around 8 or 9 most years. And this year there are 9. You have La La Land, Moonlight, Arrival, Hidden Figures, Hell or High Water, Fences, Hacksaw Ridge, Manchester by the Sea, and Lion. Now, I did put those in a particular order, which is the first 5 of those are ones that we on this show have already done a full segment on. So you can find longer discussions of those 5 back in our archives. Now, the first question I want to ask is about La La Land. La La Land is the musical directed by Damien Chazelle, who also did Whiplash, which was also nominated for Best Picture a couple of years ago. La La Land stars Ryan Gosling and Emma Stone and John Legend and some other folks, although mostly I would say those 3. And for a long time, La La Land has been considered the front runner for Best Picture. Bob, do you still think that it is the front runner for Best Picture?
I think it's still the front runner, yes. I would love to see Moonlight sneak in there.
Yeah.
And for a while, I thought it was going to.
Yeah.
There's a feeling in watching the Oscars that you have a swell and then things taper off. And so movies can peak too soon. And I know you and I thought, actually, that maybe La La Land had already peaked, but it seems to just be peeking through all over again.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of kind of negative reaction around La La Land since it became a frontrunner. I think it's
right.
One of those that has not benefited from that. And if you're interested in some of that criticism, I think one of the most thoughtful pieces is one that ran in The Hollywood Reporter just recently from Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who's become this really interesting cultural commentator and wrote a really good piece that credited it for the things that it's good at while still raising questions about elements of the story. So La La Land, you can find a discussion of. Moonlight, I'm really interested in the fact that Moonlight went from, and we've mentioned this before, but one that Bob and I both thought was too small as of Toronto.
Might not even get out of
to
Toronto.
To be nominated.
Right.
And now it's the one that folks hope will maybe upset.
Well, this folk anyway.
Yeah.
In a big way.
I was afraid that there was going to be some pushback on that movie because it's so quiet and so subtle that once it broke through to a larger audience, it wouldn't necessarily take hold.
Except that everybody seems to love it. I mean, I have never talked to anybody who's seen that movie who hasn't thought it was simply wonderful.
Right. It's a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
It is really beautiful.
And there have been some pieces written about it, about seeing it in certain audiences where there's just a very nervous laughter to anything gay happening on screen. That's another factor. That's another sort of valence of the discussion around this
film. Particularly when, as has come up every year when we talk about what's nominated and what wins, an Oscars voting body that is, I think, not quite as old and white as it was maybe a couple years ago, but still, you know, I think leans largely in that direction. So it's funny because when we talked about the Grammy Awards, we talked about the makeup of the voting body and how they're interested in kind of sustaining the business are sometimes different from what people think about.
Well, and of course, they also, the fact of La La Land being about making movies has a big effect on why people think that it's going to do well at the Oscars.
Argo and The Artist, there's kind of a history of movies doing well when they are about Hollywood. Mm-hmm.
Well, and when they're specifically celebrating the magic of Hollywood, which this this movie has some.
Here's to the ones who dream.
Yeah. I think that's going to be interesting to watch. I also took note of the fact that just recently, Hidden Figures passed La La Land to be the highest grossing of the Best Picture nominees as of right now, which I thought was sort of encouraging. And I think it will, the question will be whether if La La Land wins, will it pass Hidden Figures again? Because right now they're very close. I would love to see Hidden Figures keep that title because, boy, I like that movie too a whole lot. Yep. And we did a segment about that a few weeks ago.
Popularity doesn't ordinarily have very much to do with what wins Best Picture. Mm-hmm. May I just say that about this category, I really love the fact that you all have to say picture when you're talking about...
it's true.
But
and
the popularity of a film does do this to the act of watching the ceremony. It means that there's going to be more people invested in a way that there hasn't necessarily been in recent years.
Yeah.
And they actually expanded the number of Best Picture nominees in part to account for them kind of hoping that a big, like remember when American Sniper was nominated? Like to get something where people who have actually seen some of the movies before they see the ceremony.
Right. Yeah, but of course... That also was intended to maybe bring in like a couple blockbusters, like really good quality blockbusters. And it really has never had that effect. What it's mostly done is bring in more of the same kinds of movies that often have gotten nominated for Best Picture. Speaking of which, you have Arrival, which we really liked and which we talked about after Toronto and also did a segment about later. Hell or High Water, which we talked about just a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, which is surprising that it's here, not because it's a bad picture, but because it came out so early and because it is small, you know?
Yeah, it's much small in scale.
It's small in scale, and it's not necessarily the kind of thing that you would imagine just would be chasing Oscar gold.
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's much respected, though. I mean, it's a really smart, smaller movie, and those are I can't suss out what the Oscar voters think about when they're doing the nominations.
Yeah.
I can kind of figure out what they're thinking about once you're down to 5 or 10 movies. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, I just have no idea how things get nominated.
Yeah. I would have said, for example, that Loving, which Bob and
absolutely.
I both really liked, would have been a better bet for a Best Picture nomination than Hell or High Water until the nominations came out.
Yeah. And I have to say, I want to speak out for the quality and breadth of these nominees compared to some years. There was a year a few years ago where you had, it was the year that Birdman won, and you had movies like The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything and these kind of, I remember thinking like, this is a genre. Like Oscar movie is a genre now. Yeah. And that bummed me out. A lot of historical dramas. Mm-hmm. And this, you've got a bunch of different kinds of movies here. And Hell or High Water, I think, really speaks to that. That is it's a Western, but not a sprawling Western. Mm-hmm. It's a compact movie. Yeah. It's the kind of movie that isn't always rewarding.
Yeah, and I want to move into the ones that we have not done segments about. As you talk, Stephen, about broadening the kinds of movies that make it into Best Picture, I want to talk about Fences, which is an adaptation of the August Wilson play and directed by Denzel Washington, starring him and Viola Davis. When I was watching Fences, one of the things that I really was so happy about is it's a black family and it's a family story. And you don't always get a lot of family stories unless, like Hell or High Water, for example, it's a family story pitched toward, you know, some very dramatic single inciting incident or a family story as a background to a genre movie.
Right.
This story is really about this family.
Yeah.
Well, and it's so gorgeously written. My bias here is obviously that I love the theater so much. And so when you get something that is written like a theatrical piece, I'm inclined to like it. But this is just such gorgeous dialogue. And as you're watching it, this feeds all of the things that I love about screenplays. This particular one was also adapted by people who had done it on Broadway.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that it feels like they're living this.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because I think that's been one of the criticisms of Fences is that it plays out a little, that the word comes up, stagey, that it feels a little bit bound and constrained by its source material, that it doesn't necessarily have a lot of sprawl and movement. It's a lot of people standing against, like, toward each other and monologuing.
Surrounded by fences. I mean, there's a reason you don't go outside that yard, right?
Yeah. So. I mean, I've seen the play produced a couple times. I went into this not thinking I'm going to get anything new, any new insights, but I did because I think he made some, the director made some tweaks that you don't necessarily get in a stage production. The character of Troy, played by Denzel Washington, has an entirely different energy when he's in his backyard than he does when he's out on the street, because he's in front of the public. He's in front of his neighbors, in a way. And when he's in his backyard, even though he's just as much in front of his neighbors, because the entire neighborhood is around him, he sees it as his domain. So he is much more expansive, much bigger. I never got that.
I didn't either. That's very nice.
You can't pick up on that on stage in the same way. Mm-hmm. You certainly get a sense of claustrophobia because, you know, set designers can imply it, but here you see it and you feel it, and I just thought you get a different sense. So I was really pleased with this. I also like the fact, as many people pointed out, that this is a great work of American theater, and more people can see it now than ever will.
It's one of the conversations that I remember we had. I think about the film adaptation of the last 5 years, which is whether you think a film adaptation is completely successful. There's some value in the fact that it brings a piece to a much larger group of people. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting to me about Fences is that, as Stephen said, there's been a lot of, you know, it feels like a play. And there's a particular moment, it's really funny, there's a particular moment early in the film when Viola Davis comes out of the house and sits in a chair with some knitting, I think. And as soon as she did that, I thought, this only happens in plays. The way that she comes and joins that scene to just sit on stage. And what I thought about was, as much as it is partly the directing and it is partly the fact that there's not a lot of kind of, you know, dramatic directing, you know, showy, flashy directing, it's also just the fact that when people write for the theater, they use dialogue in different ways because they are more likely, for example, to rely on long monologues because they don't have the options that filmmakers have of, you know, a montage or, you know, a fast cutting between scenes. And so you get different devices, and I don't know that it's necessarily a bad thing, you know?
Yeah, I do think this is the Oscar clippiest of the Best Picture nomination. And I say that as a fan of this movie, and particularly as a fan of Viola Davis's performance, which
she's
is just
so
stuffed with, like, where do you, I mean, I think I know what scene they'll pick for their Oscar clip, but there are many to choose from.
Yeah, she's wonderful in it. In addition to Fences, another family story, but another one that's kind of driven by a dramatic inciting incident that we haven't done a full segment on, is Manchester by the Sea. Manchester by the Sea is a story about a man who assumes sort of custody, temporary custody, of his nephew after the death of his brother. And it eventually comes out that he has a very long and sad story of his own about how he became kind of estranged from the town where he lived. And boy, this movie is, as I think Bob and I said when we got back from Toronto, so sad.
Yeah.
It is so sad. How did you do with this movie, Thompson? I was afraid that you would find this movie too sad.
Yeah, I certainly worried about that too, because you had warned me so much. I think I wouldn't call it gratuitously sad, and I think that's one thing that helps. And I also just enormously admire the construction of this film. It's basically split into halves where there's this fulcrum in the middle that changes your perspective on everything you're seeing. And I think, without giving anything away, that is enormously powerful, and that fulcrum scene is very difficult to watch, but I think directed in a very restrained and still very powerful way by Kenneth Lonergan. This is also, I mean, it is heavily nominated. It's nominated in three different acting categories. This is a very, very powerfully acted movie. And I think you guys mentioned when you came back from Toronto, you saying, like, why is Michelle Williams in this movie? Why did they bother to put Michelle Williams in that part?
Through much of the movie, you sort of think
you
that.
You do wonder. Yeah.
And when you see, if you have not seen this movie, you will see that scene when she as her big Oscar moment. It is nuclear powered, just how much work is going into that scene.
My heart was broken. It's always gonna be broken. But I know yours is broken too.
this film is directed in such a way, it is determined not to milk what it is showing you.
Yeah.
The performance of Casey Affleck is hooded and inward. And, you know, people talk about a very naturalistic style, naturalistic direction. We see that a lot. There is something different going on here because there's a scene that takes place in a police station when something happens and nothing is done to heighten tension, to draw mm-hmm. your attention, to make you feel anything more. Mm-hmm. What you see it happen as it happens in exactly the way it would happen if you were there.
Yeah.
And it is shocking and surprising and probably, for me at least, the most effective scene
yeah.
in the film. The one that when I think about that film, there's many other things other people think about, but that's the scene
yeah.
that really brings it home because, again, so much of this performance is under the surface. So when it yeah. comes up for air, it's just heartbreaking.
You know, silence is a really interesting device in movies, and I'm thinking about it in terms of theater more than I do in terms of movies. When someone is silent on stage, they can hold the stage by being silent and just being there. It's harder in movies to do that because you're expecting motion and you're expecting all kinds of other things. And this is a theater writer, Kenneth Lonergan, who is directing a movie. And I think he was conscious of how he would deal with a character who does not express himself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the main character just basically doesn't ever tell you what he's thinking. He's like trying really hard not to.
He's the opposite of Denzel
thinking.
Washington in
exactly.
Fences.
Exactly. and so this is an interesting piece to put together with Fences in the same category because it approaches the whole notion of theatricality and film in a diametrically opposed way
yeah.
and arrives at something that is, to my thinking, every bit as powerful.
Yeah. So another one that Bob and I saw in Toronto again that I liked a lot at that time was Lion, So Lion is stars Dev Patel and Sonny Pawar, and they play the same character, Pawar when he's a little boy and Patel when he's older. And it's the story of how, as a small boy, he became separated from his family. His family was very, very poor, living in India. He was separated from his family and eventually was adopted eventually by a white family in Australia. And his mother from that family is played by Nicole Kidman. And when I saw this, I really was, it sounds like such a, because eventually he went and searched for his family, and there's kind of a hook where he used Google Earth, and it's, you know, it's kind of hooky and packaged, but at the same time, I thought it was quite touching. And you liked this one, Thompson. You talked about this in your Happy One Week.
Yeah, I loved this movie. This movie and Arrival are the two movies this year where I watched them sitting next to Katie, my girlfriend, and she said the same thing during both movies. Mop it up, Thompson.
I bet she did. What did you think of this one, Glenn?
I liked it a lot. I mean, there is a very simple, straightforward way to tell this story. And what I admired is they didn't necessarily do that. There were some complications in mm-hmm. this story
yeah. mm-hmm.
that this film does not shy away from. There's a thing with his adopted brother, which is just
yeah.
there to shine different light on who this guy is
mm-hmm.
in a way that if somebody else was making this film, they'd be like, well, that doesn't go anywhere. We need
yeah,
to
yeah,
like,
just get that guy
out of there.
Yeah.
So you need the brother there because it shines light on the relationship he had with his brother from his youth. It's such a smart but not necessarily simple kind of storytelling.
And one of the things I like about it, I think people's opinions have varied about whether the film is conscious of some of the things that Nicole Kidman's character sometimes says about having adopted him that are a little uncomfortable to look at. There's a scene in which she says to his girlfriend, who's played by Rooney Mara, we were just so blessed that they just came, you know, that he just
yeah.
came into our lives.
Yeah.
And I think much will depend on whether you think the film is or is not conscious of the fact that in that moment is the absolute heartbreak and trauma that happened to his mother in India,
yeah.
who never made a conscious decision to be separated from him. It was not a conventional adoption situation
mm-hmm.
in that sense. And I felt like the film was very conscious of it,
yeah.
but other people that I've talked to have not. So I'll be curious to hear what those of you who haven't seen it yet think about it.
This so wiped me out when I was seeing it. I this is one where at the end of the movie, you got a picture. There's like 300 critics in a auditorium, and they're all sitting there, and they're getting up. They're leaving to go to the next movie because that's what you do, and you're not watching the credits, and you get halfway out, and there's this revelation during the credits, which I will not go into, obviously, but they all sat back down, and you'd hear...
It was amazing. It's an emotional movie that I think wound up being not as neat as it could have been, and I appreciated that about it. So the last of the nominees that we have not talked about yet is Hacksaw Ridge, directed by Mel Gibson and starring Andrew Garfield as a real guy who really existed, who was a conscientious objector in World War II. You know, he never carried a rifle. He was a medic. He saved a lot of people's lives, and he later was, you know, was honored with the Medal of Honor. And
I thought your voice had gotten a little flatter on that
one. So this movie was not for Lindas, as we like to sometimes say. It's very, very gruesome. This is of the type of movie that believes the horror of war is best shown by a lot of close-up shots of people getting their heads blown off. And if that's and there's a lot of bayoneting and slashing. And if that is not for you... then this movie will not be for you.
As I understand it, Glenn and I are entirely on the same page on this one. I came to you and said that I thought the reason this got nominated was not for all that blood and gore, but rather for the early scenes that worked so well.
Yeah, and Glenn had told me.
Well, I mean, there is a flatness to the love story. There's an ultimate evil people and ultimate good. And I had different reactions to this as this film went on and as I thought about it, because again... yes, it's a very flat, one-dimensional kind of storytelling, bad people, good person. But at the heart of it, if you think about it, this guy made a very stark, one-dimensional choice. So this film is about how he reduced the world to, I'm not going to do this thing. Mm-hmm. But then you just, I mean, when you get a week out from this movie, all you remember is the last half. Because the first half is so forgettable.
Now, see, so Bob told me it was nominated because of the first half.
Exactly.
Glenn assured me it was nominated because of the second half.
Exactly.
What did you think, Thompson?
I think this movie is fairly effective for what it is. What it is going for, it is a very morally uncomplicated war movie. What bothered me, I think, the most about it was I did a lot of thinking after this movie about the nature of the violence in Mel Gibson movies. And that Mel Gibson has a fascination with gory violence as a gauntlet, as a rite of passage, in a way that I think is very different from the way somebody like Steven Spielberg shoots grisly war scenes in movies like Saving Private Ryan. If you look at Saving Private Ryan, you feel like you are immersed in this absolutely terrifying world being torn apart, and you're supposed to feel like, oh my God, war is horrid. And not just like war is hell, war is blah, 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 but like, what would you do? It puts you in that very disorienting space. In this movie, there are tons of like very carefully choreographed, I would describe them almost like ballet, these scenes of grisly war violence, but it doesn't feel realistic. It's done in this very grandiose way. It feels almost like it's fetishizing the violence in a way that I found really uncomfortable to watch.
And aiming it at one person, one innocent person in the middle, who is actually raised on there's a sequence where he is, I describe this in my review, is he's one bent arm away from a crucifixion.
There's a lot of crucifixion imagery. There's a lot of that stuff. And my issue with it was, when it wasn't doing this massive violence, to me, it was very cliched. To me, it was, you know, all the villains are sort of cartoon villains of military men who are like, I don't respect you, son. You won't shoot anyone. And then it sort of, I didn't care for the writing. It was not for me. But it is nominated for Best Picture. So if you like a war movie, it is one.
that's on the poster. It's too bad this movie already came out. They could have put that on the poster.
They could have used me for the blurb. So those are the Best Picture nominees. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about a few other aspects of the Oscars, getting you ready for Sunday night's festivities. So come right back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Missing Richard Simmons, a new podcast that follows filmmaker Dan Taberski's search for fitness guru Richard Simmons. It's 3 years since Simmons disappeared, and Dan Taberski wants to know why. He talks to regulars from Simmons' exercise class, as well as fans, former friends, and celebrities to better understand who Simmons is and what happened to him. Subscribe now to Missing Richard Simmons on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour. In any given year, there are more than 100,000 albums released. That's nearly 2,000 albums a week. We know it's impossible to keep up with that much music, so NPR's All Songs Considered is here to help. Each week, hosts Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton find the best of the best new music. Subscribe to All Songs Considered now at npr.org/podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. So we are going to move on to some things outside of the Best Picture race. But before we do, I do want to go around the table and do our should win, will win for Best Picture. We're going to start off with that. Steven, give me your should win, will win.
I mean, I think most of you guys are going to say Moonlight should win. And I love Moonlight. But I have to admit, my actual favorite is Arrival. Mm. La La Land will win.
I'd love to see Arrival win because it's a science fiction film. I'd love science fiction to get some love. But I think it should be Moonlight. It will be La La Land.
I agree entirely with Glenn.
And I agree with Bob and Glenn. So, I am officially abandoning my prediction that La La Land is going to be caught at the last moment by the nipping Moonlight. And one of the reasons why I think that's going to happen ties into the next thing that I want to talk about, which is one of the big races, which is Best Actor. Mm. And mm-hmm. the Best Actor race, for a really long time, Casey Affleck, I think, was seen to be kind of running away with this race. He won some early awards. It is a really stunning performance, I think, in Manchester by the Sea. You know, and I don't know for sure that this is where that began to shift, but there was a lot of increased attention on some sexual harassment allegations that had been directed at him during the filming of I'm Still Here in 2010. Mm-hmm. And you can read more detail about those claims, but once that came out, I did feel like the momentum that was around his performance kind of slowed, and the Screen Actors Guild Award went to Denzel Washington for Fences, yeah. which I also think would be an awfully good pick. Yeah. What do you think, Bob?
Well, I think that it's going to be a squeaker in a way, although we don't ever find out what the votes
right,
were.
Right, no, sure.
But I would be really surprised if Casey Affleck did not win it. And I think that as good as Denzel Washington is in the picture, I think that Casey Affleck is doing film acting in a different kind of way
yeah.
for this, that to be able to do it essentially without words is, you could say maybe that's the director making him wonderful, but he was wonderful.
Yeah.
No love for in case there is a La La Land sweep, no love for Ryan Gosling. No love for
None.
Andrew Garfield
None.
From Hacksaw Ridge.
Zero.
What about Viggo Mortensen?
What about
Viggo come on. Why is he even nominated? I don't get that.
Bob really has, it is stuck in Bob's craw, this Viggo Mortensen nomination.
Drives me crazy.
What do you think, Glenn?
People talk about the Michelle Williams presence in Manchester by the Sea, that scene that she, you know, everybody says earns her nomination. Mm-hmm. In that scene, I was impressed by what she did. I couldn't take my eyes off of Casey Affleck because right. what he was doing was saying, no, don't do this, don't do this, in ways that was just, you could just tell how uncomfortable he was. So even though I had written down here, should win, will win, Denzel Washington, the more I think about that scene, I think it's Casey Affleck's to lose.
Yeah. When you get over to actress, best actress, you get into more films that aren't nominated as much in some of the other categories. Yeah. You don't get as much overlap with the other major categories. Mm-hmm. Isabelle Huppert for Elle. And Ruth Negga for Loving, which Bob and I have both expressed our affection for already. Mm. Natalie Portman and Jackie, a film that I did not love all of, no. but I understood the appeal of her performance in it. Emma Stone in La La Land. And then Meryl Streep in Florence Foster Jenkins. And I say that not because I don't love Meryl Streep. Who wouldn't love Meryl Streep? But I've seen Meryl Streep win a lot, and it's not good television. Meryl Streep winning is not good television.
Yes, on the other
Except
hand,
she gives good speeches.
She
Go
gives
ahead,
good
Bob.
Speeches. I was about to say that yeah. the president doesn't love Meryl Streep, so that would
That's
be
probably true.
You know,
yes.
I think it's Yes, I think it doesn't make a lot of sense to talk about other people in this category besides. Well, wait a minute. I kept waiting for you to say Viola Davis, and she's not
supporting.
In this
she's
category.
Supporting.
Exactly.
Yeah, she's in supporting,
right.
Which I think is weird. I think she could easily be in lead and would belong there, and
yeah.
I would probably be my pick if she were there, although I also think Ruth Negga is wonderful. What do you think, Thompson?
Yeah, I think Emma Stone's going to win this. I think that Natalie Portman and Jackie, I think, was kind of an early frontrunner. I'm not sure how much love there is for that movie. I'm kind of with Linda on that. To me, that was a little bit of a performance in search of a movie to put it in. I didn't even necessarily attach very strongly to that performance. I know I like this movie quite a bit less than Glenn, with whom I'm making eye contact right now.
Yeah.
I do think Meryl Streep is quite good in Florence Foster Jenkins. I think that movie, that's a small movie, she's terrific.
I'm telling you right now, I haven't even seen it yet. So I have nothing against Meryl Streep winning for Florence Foster Jenkins, except that it's not good television.
I do like the fact that Ruth Negga is nominated here. That is a very subtle performance of the kind that doesn't always get awards consideration.
Yeah.
Right. The film L is a head-scratcher of a film.
Yeah.
That it's a Paul Verhoeven film. He is prone to emotional extremes. He's prone to extremes. While this film has some extreme elements, and because this film has such extreme elements in it, but sort of weirdly disguised extreme elements, you get the sense that the film doesn't really know what it's about, what it's doing. It's about a woman who gets brutally sexually assaulted and then spends the rest of the film behaving in ways that do not conform to a typical victim narrative. That's the tension of the film. So again, the film's all over the place. It ends weirdly, but I never for a second doubted that Isabelle Huppert knew exactly what she was doing.
Yeah.
This performance is riveting. You don't like her, it doesn't matter, because she is just such a great presence. So I'd love to see her win. She's not gonna. It's gonna be Emma Stone.
If that performance was in English, she probably would win. She is she is regarded, outside of this country, she is regarded as the greatest actress working in film today.
Yeah.
I think most people think that her performances are natural in a way that feels real.
Mm-hmm.
I am fascinated by how many of the performances that I really like this year are performances that underdid. I mean, the Ruth Negga performance is a perfect example in Loving, that there is nothing showy about that. And there's nothing really showy about the Manchester by the Sea performance by Casey Affleck. And I'm really liking performances where the performer is not pushing.
And I would say that's true of the performances in Moonlight as well.
Yeah.
And Mahershala Ali is nominated in supporting. I love that performance.
Yeah.
By the way, I also love him in Hidden Figures.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I will watch him in everything.
It was the year of him and Janelle Monáe as acting in movies together.
Absolutely. I was like, bring me all the movies with both of them in them. Stephen, I want to talk to you about a category that I know you have made yourself a resident expert.
Oh, really?
And that is this year's animated feature nominee. Mm.
Yeah, I've managed to see all five of the nominated movies, which used to be a lot easier.
So these are Kubo and the Two Strings, Moana, My Life as a Zucchini, The Red Turtle, and Zootopia.
Yeah. Well, I think Zootopia is going to win. I think Zootopia meets at that midpoint of critical appreciation and mammoth box office.
Mm-hmm.
And a movie that I think really hit people a little harder than they expected to be hit by an animated movie called Zootopia.
Mm-hmm.
Moana, we've discussed Moana on this show before. Mm-hmm. I think it's a very, very effective Disney movie. It's one that I ended up seeing a second time and liked even more the second time. The other three are a little bit of a mixed bag for me. The Red Turtle, I made my kids sit down and watch it with me, and they were so bored. They were just crawling under their clothing.
Steven, I am so sorry. I didn't tell you not to watch this with kids.
but there are some
meditative. Meditative.
It's meditative.
Is that what
That's
it is?
A great word for it.
I haven't seen it. I'm just guessing.
No, meditative is a very good word for it in good ways and in bad. It's very slow. It's very quiet and pretty. It has some interesting thought-provoking elements. It did not, for me, cohere. My Life as a Zucchini is a very charming and melancholy bit of like stop motion animation. Very, very short film, like 65 minutes long, like really at the edge of feature length. I found it charming, and I was glad that I had a chance to see it because of this. Kubo and the Two Strings, I just got done watching before we stepped into the studio to tape this, and I'm here to tell you, I think it should have been nominated for Best Picture.
Definitely. Yeah. I agree with that.
This is a very elaborate quest story with supernatural elements about basically a boy who goes on a quest with the help of a monkey played by Furiosa from Mad Max Fury Road, actual Charlize Theron, a dim-witted beetle, samurai beetle, played by Matthew McConaughey, and they do battle underwater, they do battle in, there is a scene with a gigantic skeleton. This is not a movie for little kids, by the way. There's a scene with this giant skeleton that is just one of the most visually stunning scenes. Scene after scene after scene in this movie, I thought, how did they do that? And in the closing credits to Kubo and the Two Strings, there is a scene where the filmmakers are erecting, they speed up the film, so you see them erecting this massive skeleton in order to shoot this scene. I love this movie.
So I do want to touch on one more thing before we close out of our Oscar conversation, and that is the discussion over the last several years about the whiteness of the Oscar nominees. I would say on the in front of the camera side in the major categories, you see some greater diversity. You see in the best supporting actress category, 3 out of the 5 actresses are Black women: Viola Davis in Fences, Naomi Harris in Moonlight, and Octavia Spencer in Hidden Figures. Mahershala Ali is nominated for Moonlight.
Dev Patel
is nominated. Denzel Washington is nominated, as we've talked about. You have Ruth Negga in Loving that we talked about. So I think there's some improvement in front of the camera. And behind the camera, people have talked a lot about the documentary category, where 4 out of the 5 directors are directors of color. So,
and you can make a case for Zootopia as a film about race. This has been very much on the minds of people in Hollywood this year. There's no question about that. I think it's behind the camera that is more problematic. There are very few women directors around.
I was just going to say, where you do not see a ton of progress is women in the non-specifically gendered categories. Directors, also screenwriters. Women are shut out of a lot of these.
Yeah, you have Ava DuVernay for 13th for documentary, but not a lot else.
It's still very limited. Don't pat anybody on the back quite yet. You also still have a dearth of Asian American and Latino actors and directors, and there's millions of problems yet to be solved. So my feeling is, don't get too excited about the Oscar nominations just yet. Progress remains slow, I would argue. And before we get off of the Oscars entirely, I want to do a very quick round of, if you could give one nomination that didn't come through, who would you give your nomination to? Stephen Thompson.
For Best Original Song, I think I would take away maybe one of the La La Land choices, or maybe the Sting song, and plug in, I mentioned a couple weeks ago the short film Pearl, and I've gotten flooded with people like reaching out and tweeting me saying like, I saw this because you recommended it, I loved it. The song that anchors that sweet little short film is called No Wrong Way Home. It's written by Alexis Hart and J.J. Weisler, and is performed by Kelly Stoltz and Nikki Bloom.
I hope you dream, don't feel small, and when the wind begins to rise, I hope your mast stands straight and tall. These are fragile times, we blur the lines. In the unlikeliest of places, we all find a little grace. There's no wrong way.
It is a gorgeous song, and without it, that film would be much less powerful.
Thank you, Stephen Thompson. Glenn?
This will be quick. I'm a broken record, but Annette Bening's performance in 20th Century Women, Best Actress, she should win Best Actress because she is doing so much by showing us so little. There's nothing chewy to hang on to. There's no big speeches. It's all pure reaction.
I think that Dev Patel gave a wonderful performance in Lion, but that Sonny Pawar should have been nominated for the Best Supporting Actor part. It seems to me that he was in the picture more than Dev Patel was.
Very nice. So. Very nice. I would give my nomination to Loving, which I think is a wonderful movie. I would have put it in for Best Picture. I think it's the kind of movie where that helps people go see it, and I think it's terrific and avoids a ton of possible cliches. Love it. Love it. Love it. That is our Oscars coverage. On Sunday night, we will be on Twitter. We will be social media-ing all up in this piece. We will also be doing a small batch, which will drop sometime while you are getting your good night's sleep post-Oscars. So when we come back, it's going to be time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What is Making Us Happy This Week? So come right back.
Support for this podcast comes from SimpliSafe, an award-winning home security company. Their system uses an arsenal of wireless sensors and has 24/7 professional monitoring. Plus, you pay by month and never get tricked into a long-term contract. SimpliSafe has no installation costs and no hidden fees, so you can protect your home and family the smart way. Right now, listeners of this podcast can get 10% off any home security system, only if you go to simplysafenpr.com.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. It is time for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week, Wisconsin?
Well, speaking of the Midwest, we have I'm going to kick off with a very special announcement. Pop Culture Happy Hour is about to play its first Midwest live show in Chicago at the Harris Theater on Wednesday, April 12th. Mark your calendars now. Tickets are going to go on sale Wednesday, March 8th. We'll have more information on where you can go to get those tickets, but mark your calendar. Tickets, Wednesday, March 8th. Show, Wednesday, April 12th. Harris Theater in Chicago, our fourth chair, Sam Sanders.
It's very exciting.
It's really exciting. Sam Sanders, you may know him from the NPR Politics podcast and a bunch of really exciting new NPR podcast projects. Also, I have been watching a lot of the Cartoon Network lately because Steven Universe is back on. And on the Cartoon Network, they have started showing ads for the TV adaptation of Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. I am a huge, huge fan of the Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs movies. The series, I've only seen clips of this show online. I haven't gotten a chance to preview full episodes yet. But it seems to be very much in the spirit of the original kind of Lord and Miller sensibility. I'm always looking for more of this franchise, so I am excited. It's coming out March 6th on the Cartoon Network, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs.
Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Keeping on the Cartoon Network tip, Justice League Action is a series featuring characters from the DC Universe, 15-minute-long episodes. The design's great. The writing is great. I think it really comes alive when it moves its focus away from the big three, away from Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman, and you get some of the deep bench. It has a tone that's somewhere between Batman Brave and the Bold, which was kind of goofy and fun, and Justice League Unlimited, which was just sprawling the entire DC universe. It features the vocal talents of Diedrich Bader, Hannibal Buress, Gary Cole, Gilbert Gottfried, Cloris Leachman, Patton Oswalt playing Space Cabbie, a cabbie in space.
Sure.
Andy Richter, Carl Reiner, Stephen Tobolowsky, James Woods as Lex Luthor. That's good casting. And it features in one episode, or one recent episode, there are two swamp monsters in the DC universe. One's good, one's bad. I want you to compare and contrast these two clips because I think it makes a point about what the show is doing right. The first voice we'll hear is Solomon Grundy. He's the evil swamp monster. He is voiced by Fred Tatasciore. As we join him, he has just beaten up Swamp Thing and is about to lead his army of zombies away.
That's the end of him. Come on, you bone bags! On to New Orleans!
And now we're going to hear from Swamp Thing, the good swamp monster, voiced by Mark Hamill. He has several voices on the show. And he is dusting himself off and prepared to go and chase Solomon Grundy.
Headed to New Orleans.
Did you notice anything between those two?
One's deeper than the other.
Solomon Grundy said New Orleans.
Yeah.
Swamp Thing, the hero, said New Orleans. That is a kind of tiny characterization choice that this show is filled with. Not saying that people who pronounce it like New Orleans is, but see, Solomon Grundy is from Gotham City, so he would say New Orleans. But Swamp Thing is from Louisiana, he would say New Orleans. It's just
goodness.
That kind of smart little tiny things that are in it for people like me, but it's also a great show. Justice League Action.
Thank you
so
very
detailed.
Much. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Bob Mondello, what is making you happy this week?
Well, I'm a theater nut, and I went to the theater, and ordinarily I would hesitate about recommending something I had seen in the theater because you can only see it here in Washington, mm-hmm. but this is a play that's being done all over the country that was done not too long ago on Broadway. It is called King Charles III, and it is a new play written in Shakespearean style about Prince Charles, imagining what happens after Queen Elizabeth dies and Prince Charles finally becomes King Charles III. It's written in blank verse. It's written in the style of Shakespeare. You see Shakespeare differently as a result of watching what has been done with this play. It's a really interesting piece of work.
Thank you very much, Bob Mondello. You have heard about this from Glenn, but I am going to talk to you about My Brother and Me, and specifically the podcast My Brother and Me, which many of you know and love, is being made into a television show, which will be, by the time you hear this, available on CISO, which is the same online outlet that brought you Take My Wife, which we really liked. Mm-hmm. The show involves the McElroy brothers, Justin, Travis, and Griffin, who go around their hometown of Huntington, West Virginia, being very charming and goofy, just doing stuff. There is a frame which involves them giving advice and taking a question and all that stuff, but they're just goofing around. It's really fun. I liked it a lot. There are 6 episodes. I really dug it. It's such an easy watch, and you get to meet many of the charming denizens of Huntington, and I strongly recommend it. And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. You can follow Glenn at GH Weldon. And you can follow Bob at Bob_Mondello. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And our producer emeritus and music director and pal for life, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello, Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. So enjoy the Oscars, and thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
A pleasure.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.